Started here last week or last Wednesday night. In chapter 6 and 7, the father is giving the son practical advice on a number of different subjects. In the first part of chapter 6, he talks about being a surety for a friend. This would be similar today to being a cosigner on a loan for someone, where you might put something of value to yourself up as a loan. When you have something of value and you put that up against the loan. A guarantee. Collateral, that's the word I was looking for, collateral on a loan. And in those days, an Israelite could put himself up for collateral, and that may be what's being spoken of here. In a situation like this, what's one of the worst things that could happen to someone who has been a surety or put themselves up for collateral or made themselves a co-signer on another person's loan? Back in those days, what's one thing that could happen to you? You could be sold. So what he's talking about here is putting yourself into a very vulnerable position for a friend. You've got a friend that needs money, or he's got some business dealing that he wants to go into, and you help him by becoming a guarantee or a co-signer to the loan that he's taken. And for several verses, he talks about the extremes that you need to go to get out of that situation if you find yourself in it. If you do something so foolish, then get out of it as quickly as possible. He compares it to a bird, for instance, that's been caught in a snare, or an animal that's been trapped by a hunter. What do you see from an animal or a bird that's been caught in a trap alive? That panic, do everything they can to get out. They're frantic. I've heard of people capturing large raccoons in these live wire traps. And I've heard of more than one instance where that raccoon would literally tear that metal trap to shreds to get out. My dad caught one in a trap like that one time and actually found it down a hill where the raccoon or whatever animal had torn the trap apart and rolled down the hill in it. He was absolutely frantic to escape. And what he's saying here, that if you have put yourself into a position like this, you are trapped like an animal, and you need to get out of it. He talks about humbling yourself, doing whatever you can to get out of that situation, because you've put yourself into a situation where your very freedom, if not a good deal of your material possessions, are at the mercy of another person and their actions. It's one thing to obligate yourself when you're the person who's responsible, when it's your actions that you're depending on. But when you place yourself in a position like that where you're dependent upon the actions of another person, you're in a very bad position. Pardon? That's right.
Don't just sit there. See, you said go to sleep, or just sit back and think everything will be all right. It may not be.
It may not be. All right, after talking about that, beginning in verse 6, he begins to talk about sloth, laziness. In verse 6, he says, "Go to the ant, thou sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest." So an ant doesn't need what in order to know to prepare for hard times. Pardon? Don't have to have a chief captain. An ant doesn't have to have somebody constantly nagging at them and seeing after them to get the job done. An ant just naturally knows to take care of itself. And he's telling the son here, be that way. Don't be the kind of person that has to have someone constantly nagging after them in order to do the things that need to be done. Yeah. The evolutionists would have us believe that the ant figured out how to do that over time. He goes on talking about sleep. How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall thy poverty come as one that travaileth, and thy want as an armed man. Again, talking about laziness here, in particular sleep. The person that wants to sleep all day. There's a lot of work that needs to be done in order to take care of oneself. And particularly in an agricultural society where you might not have that boss calling to find out where you are, why you didn't show up for work, where you don't have somebody else making your schedule for you, it can be very easy to let things slide, to sleep in and not get the work done. Beginning in verse 12, he talks about the naughty person, the person who's crooked and deceitful. We're told he has a froward mouth, and as we've talked about before, that comes from a word that carries with the idea of being crooked. And I would gather from the roots of this word that it's talking about somebody who is deceitful in their speech. He winks with his eye. He speaketh with his feet. He teacheth with his fingers. Frowardness is in his heart. He deviseth mischief continually. He soweth discord. He's deceitful. He's conniving. He's a person who sows discord either because he just enjoys watching other people fuss, or it could be that he sows discord in order to gain an advantage in a situation. If you get people at odds with each other, sometimes you can take advantage of them because their attention is somewhere besides on what you're doing. Then it talks about what will happen to the person who does that in verse 15. Therefore shall his calamity come suddenly. Suddenly shall he be broken without remedy. Person will come to grief. He behaves that way, if not in this life, then certainly when it comes time to give an account for their actions to God. In verse 16, he begins talking about six things that the Lord hates and seven that are an abomination. What's one of the first things he mentions? Pardon? Pride. He says a proud look. And as we go through this, remember, this is the son, the father telling the son, here are things that God hates. These aren't just things that men dislike. These aren't just things that won't help you get by in the world. These are things that God actually hates. So he's talking to the son. He says, listen, young man, these are things God hates. The first thing he mentions is pride or a proud look. What else does he mention? A lying tongue. And then hands that shed innocent blood. He's already talked about that to the son before. Don't let people talk you into these schemes. Go out and commit crime, commit murder in order to get money. God hates that. He hates a proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood. What else? Right, a false witness is mentioned. A false witness that speaketh lies. What about the heart? All right, always scheming, always thinking up some evil in order to get, usually to get easy money, easy gain. Feet that are swift to running to mischief. Person that sows discord among brethren. We'll see that in different places in the book of Proverbs. And in fact, we've already seen this mentioned before. Person that sows discord. So those are things that God hates, that He finds an abomination. Beginning in verse 20, He talks again about the need to listen to the father and to the mother. In verse 23, talking about the law of the father and mother, He says, "For the commandment is a lamp, and the law is light, and reproof of instruction or the way of life," similar to Psalm 119:105, where it talks about God's law being a lamp unto His feet and a light unto His way. But notice how verse 23 leads into verse 24. What is this lamp and this light and accepting these reproofs, what are they going to help the young man do? And what, and stay out of trouble, what particular trouble does he mention beginning in verse 24? All right, the adulterous woman, the evil woman again. And we see this over and over, chapters 1 through 9, and this is not the last time that he's going to mention the immoral woman. He talks a lot about where the immoral woman would be seen, usually on the streets, to get attention. Nowadays, are the streets the only place that a young person is liable to see an immoral person who might be inclined to entice them? No, it's not. Just about everywhere. All kinds of reading material, magazines. The internet is a particular problem today. Television, movies. As a parent today, as people who have influence over young individuals, we need to be preparing them and talking to them about these different avenues and different ways that they're going to be enticed by the type of people that are described here as the immoral woman. And it's not just the young men these days, but the young ladies as well that are going to need help along that line. And we need to be aware of that, and we need to be willing to talk to them about that and prepare them as the father does here in Proverbs 1 through 9. This section is particularly interesting because it talks about the consequences to an individual who commits adultery with another man's wife. He says in verse 27 and 28, "Can a man take fire into his bosom and his clothes and not be burned? Can one go upon hot coals and his feet not be burned?" Committing adultery, as is described here, will bring consequences just as surely as gathering up fire into your hands and trying to put it in your pockets. That's what he's telling the young person. In verse 20, "So is he that goeth into his neighbor's wife. Whoso toucheth her shall not be innocent. Men do not despise a thief if he steal to satisfy his soul when he is hungry. But if he be found, he shall restore sevenfold. He shall give all the substance of his house. But whoso committeth adultery with a woman lacketh understanding. He that doeth it destroyeth his own soul. A wound and dishonor shall he get. And his reproach shall not be wiped away. For jealousy is the rage of a man, therefore he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will not regard any ransom, neither will he rest content, though thou givest many gifts." If a person steals because they're hungry, even though we don't necessarily condone that theft, we at least have some sympathy and some understanding for what they've done, don't we? And I'm sure many of us have heard different stories of people that have seen or experienced occasions where somebody was in deep want for something and they would see them commit a crime. And there is a certain amount of sympathy for that person because they're doing it out of desperation. But here he says, not only do we have that sympathy for that person, but he can repay that. Now, you can take that person, maybe put them to work, they could get a job, and eventually they can recompense not only what they've stolen, but they can also pay a fine for that. But what is a person going to pay a man when he's committed adultery with that man's wife? Nothing. There is nothing that you can ever say or do, no amount of money that you can ever pay, that's going to wipe away that infraction. That person's jealousy is going to be such that you're not going to be able to satisfy their anger. Not only that, but the other people will look at you as someone who has done something very dishonorable. Unlike the thief who's desperate, who needs it, and does something wrong, but at least they have a motive that we can understand, as opposed to the person who commits adultery. What well-known Old Testament character committed adultery and was rebuked with very much the same idea in mind? All right, David. Remember the parable told by Nathan the prophet, or the story that he told about the man that had great wealth and great flocks, but instead of taking one of a sheep out of his own flock to feed a guest, he stole the or took the poor man's only lamb that was a pet, and how despicable David saw that. And that is the view that people take of the person that commits adultery in this way. And that's the lesson the father is trying to teach the son. Right, are there any questions or comments about anything we've talked about so far? And we've seen that before, how the father warns the son that that type of lifestyle leads to poverty, it leads to physical ruin, leads to financial ruin. All right, let's look at chapter 7. Chapter 7 is almost a continuation of the thought there in chapter 6. The first few verses, again, he is pleading with the son to listen to his words. And then he begins to go into this description of the immoral woman that he says that he saw from his window. And he observed her and her behavior. And he observed the behavior of the person that she was enticing. What are some of the characteristics of this woman? What's one of the first things that she does in order to entice the young man? All right, she dresses like a harlot. Calls attention to herself. Also mentioned that she flatters. She's a flatterer, a smooth talker. She does her work at night. She can be recognized by her attire. Let's look at some other characteristics that after it mentions that she met him with the attire of a harlot, it says in verse 11, she's loud and stubborn. Her feet abide not in her house. So another one of her characteristics is she's loud. She is the type of person that likes to call attention to herself. She wants to be the center of attention. If she's at a party or at a gathering or in a crowd, everybody knows she's there. And she makes sure that everybody knows that she's there. Mentions that she's stubborn. It says that she lies in wait for him like a predator. So she caught him and kissed him. Says that she has an impudent face. Word that's translated impudent there carries with it the idea of being hardened. I think that the idea in mind is that she is a person who is so callous and hardened to her way of life that she can lie and cheat and commit adultery and do it with a straight face. She can flatter this young man. The whole time she's deceiving him and seducing him. But she can keep a straight face while she's doing that. She's hardened. Her conscience is seared. Shameless. That's a good rendering of the idea, I think, in mind with that word that's translated impudent. Mentions the different things that she says. She's a very smooth talker. And she makes the sin sound so enticing. She talked about all the preparations that she's made. She makes it sound very enticing, very pleasant. She makes it sound like there's not going to be any consequences because the husband's gone. He's taken a bag of money with him. He's on a long journey. Nobody's going to catch us. And it says that the person that goes in is like an ox that's going to the slaughter. Satan used these very same techniques on Eve in the garden in Genesis chapter 3. Having her look at the apple, think about how good it was for food, that it would enlighten her eyes, and trying to deceive her into thinking that there wouldn't be any consequences. Pardon? Did I say apple? I'm sorry. You know, that's the second time I've done that in a class like this. I apologize. There's nowhere in the Bible is it mentioned that it's an apple. That is, I'm sorry. That's just an old tradition, and I really apologize for saying that. I appreciate you stopping me and pointing that out. Thank you. Okay. The fruit. And we don't know what type of fruit it was. And I need to be more careful in my speech along that line. Yes, sir. It's almost like she thinks that she can preemptively pay for this sin. Pardon? Yeah. Preemptive penance. Yeah. Trying like Satan did to make it sound like everything's all right, that there's not going to be any consequences for the actions. But he points out again that the person that listens to her is like an ox going to the slaughter, a fool going to the stocks, and that a dart or a javelin would strike through the liver as the bird hasteth to the snare. And knoweth not that it is for his life. That's the description of the fool that gives in to her enticements.
That's like that when they had heard it, surely in vain the net is spread and the fighter in the bird. Let's see what he's getting into.
Mm-hmm. Beginning in verse 24, it continues to talk about the destructiveness of this woman. And how many that she has destroyed with her ways. It says her house is the way to hell, going down to the chambers of death.
Don't you think of the woman in
Okay, the great harlot is mentioned in the book of Revelation. All right, any other questions or comments before we go to chapter 8? Is it? That's right.
That's a code to the fact that repetition is a code we have to use.
That's right.
Get the point across.
It's a tool that God uses in His instructions to us, and it's a tool that we need to use in working with young people and even with adults. It's a tool that the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter used in their writings. And even mentioned on different occasions that what they were telling the people isn't something new that they hadn't heard before. But this is just to remind you of the things that you've been told before. All right, chapter 8 contains a number of characteristics of wisdom. I'm not going to read every verse. We'll just look at some of the points that are made here about wisdom. In verses 1 through 6, as has been pictured before, wisdom is shown as being out there looking for people that are willing to listen to wisdom. It's not hiding. Wisdom isn't hiding for us. God has blessed us with an abundance of wisdom in His Word. And it's just sitting there waiting for us, pleading with us to come and study it, to understand it, to become familiar with it. We're told that the words of wisdom give us truth versus wickedness in verses 7 through 9. Wisdom here is personified. It's with wisdom speaking to us. It says, "For my mouth shall speak truth, and wickedness is abomination to my lips. All the words of my mouth are in righteousness. There is nothing froward or perverse in them. They are plain to him that understandeth and right to them that would find knowledge." So wisdom gives us truth versus wickedness, righteousness versus deceit and perverseness. And it's plain and right to those that are seeking understanding. In verses 10 and 11, wisdom is compared to silver and gold. And we're told not only silver and gold, but rubies as well. And pictured as being much more desirable, much more valuable than gold and jewels. In verse 12, wisdom is a source of understanding. It's a source of subtleness and cleverness so that you can understand things that are subtle. And the clever inventions of others. Verse 13, we get back to the association between wisdom and righteousness and wisdom and the fear of the Lord. It says, "The fear of the Lord is to hate evil. Pride and arrogancy and the evil way and the froward mouth do I hate." And again, this isn't something new. He's already told the young man this when he was talking about the seven things that God hates. So again, God hates arrogance and pride, the evil way and the froward mouth. In verses 14 through 16, it talks about wisdom and its association with those in power. When a person in a position of power and authority, like a prince or a king or a judge, when they exercise their responsibilities correctly, they do so through wisdom. In verses 17 through 21, he talks about the rewards of wisdom. He said, "I love them that love me, and those that seek me early shall find me. Riches and honor are with me, yea, durable riches and righteousness." And going back to verse 17, again, wisdom isn't hiding from us. If we want it, if our heart is right and we look for it, we pick up God's Word and read it and study it with the right attitude and heart, we're going to grow in wisdom. It's not hiding from us. He goes on and talks about riches and honor being with wisdom. Verse 19, again, comparing wisdom to gold and silver. He says, "My fruit is better than gold, yea, than fine gold, and my revenue than choice silver. I lead in the way of righteousness in the midst of paths of judgment." Why is it that the fruits of wisdom are better than gold and silver? They're perishable. And we're talking about what kind of wisdom again? Wisdom that comes from godly wisdom that will ultimately lead to a life in heaven for all eternity if we will heed the wisdom that comes from God. Beginning in verse 23 and going down through verse 21, it talks about wisdom and its close association with God. In verse 23, it says, "I was set up from everlasting, from the beginning, or ever the earth was. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no fountains abounding with water, before the mountains were settled, before the hills, was I brought forth. While as yet he had not made the earth, nor the fields, nor the highest part of the dust of the world. When he prepared the heavens, I was there. When he set a compass upon the face of the depth. When he established the clouds above. When he strengthened the fountains of the deep. When he gave to the sea his decree that the water should not pass his commandment. When he appointed the foundations of the earth. When I was by him as one brought up with him. And I was daily his delight, rejoicing always before him. Rejoicing in the habitable part of the earth, and my delights were with the sons of men." How long has wisdom been around?
Forever.
Wisdom has been God's constant companion. And here, in particular, it shows that wisdom existed before the world, before God even created the earth. But God, being who He is, always has wisdom as His companion. It is as eternal as He is because of His nature. In verses 32 through 36, continues talking about the blessings of wisdom. The man who would receive wisdom is blessed. He's going to find life or length of days. He also finds favor with God in verse 35. And then the warning that the person who rejects wisdom, he wrongs his own soul. And the person that rejects wisdom, that hate wisdom, is someone who loves death. And again, in verse 36, the idea that if we reject wisdom, then the problems that we encounter are problems that we bring on ourselves. It isn't somebody else's fault. It's our own. All right, any questions or comments about chapter 8?
Mm-hmm.
the universe is put together in such a wonderful way. And in many respects, the laws of nature are held together by such a delicate balance that wisdom truly had to be behind it. God is wise, and His wisdom is as eternal as He is, and that wisdom can be seen in His creation. Chapter 9 continues to deal with the nature of wisdom, the benefits of wisdom. It has some practical, I guess you could say, practical day-to-day type of instructions included as well. Warnings, again, against the immoral woman that's talked about so much in the book of Proverbs. Beginning in verse 1, it says, "Wisdom hath builded her house, she hath hewn out her seven pillars. She hath killed her beasts, she hath mingled her wine. She hath also furnished her table. She hath sent forth her maidens, she cried upon the highest places of the city. Whoso is simple, let him turn in hither. As for him that wanteth understanding, she saith to him, Come, eat of my bread, and drink of the wine which I have mingled. Forsake the foolish, and live, and go in the way of understanding." And again, this theme that we see repeated over and over again here in chapters 1 through 9. Wisdom is inviting us. Here it talks about she's built the house. She's prepared the feast. She's sent people out with invitations. Wisdom, again, is not hiding from us. God is pleading with us to take advantage of what He has set before us. Yeah, we sometimes think of the term simple in respect to somebody who may have some difficulty learning, some comprehension problem. But here it's simply the person who hasn't been educated. And if the simple, the uneducated, the person who has not yet received wisdom is receptive, then wisdom will be theirs to have. Beginning in verse 5, or 7 rather, we have a contrast to the way men treat wisdom and reproof, or instruction and reproof. He says, "He that reproveth a scorner getteth himself shame, and he that rebuketh a wicked man getteth himself a blot." Trying to teach some people, trying to reprove some people, it just causes you trouble. They turn on you. They don't appreciate it. They treat you in a shameful way. He says in verse 8, "Reprove not a scorner, lest he hate thee." But contrast that with a wise man. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love thee. You can see that readily in the world around us. There are people that if you try to correct them, if you try to help them, it just makes them angry. They don't like it. What is it about receiving instruction or receiving correction that some people dislike so much? What makes them so angry when somebody tries to help them by teaching them to do better than they're doing? They think they've got all the answers. It's pride, usually, isn't it? If somebody comes along and says, you know, that there's a better way to do what you're doing. If I accept that, then it means I've got to accept the fact that this person knows more about what I'm doing than I do. And that some people can't stand that. Yes, sir.
It's always a wise thing. A lot of people won't listen. You've heard that phrase. It's always a wise thing to listen to what people tell you, whether it's right or wrong. Mm-hmm.
Back many, yeah. A smart person realizes that or appreciates being taught a better way to do things or being taught better. Yeah. In verses 10 through 12, in verse 10, he says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom," again showing the connection between righteousness and the fear of God and wisdom. In verses 10 through 12, he also points out that wisdom promotes a long life. And we alone are responsible for whether or not we accept or reject wisdom. He said, "If thou be wise, thou shalt be wise for thyself. But if thou scornest, thou alone shalt bear it." It's our responsibility. We're not hurting anybody but ourselves if we reject it. In verses 13 through 18, he talks about the immoral woman. He says, "A foolish woman is clamorous. She is simple and knoweth nothing." When it says she's clamorous, what does that remind you of? Something you may have said earlier about an immoral woman.
Loud and boisterous.
Loud and boisterous. She's just always has to be noticed. He says, "She sitteth at the door of her house on a seat in the high places of the city to call passengers who go right on their ways." Again, picturing her as being a predator. She's sitting out there waiting for people. She's calling attention to herself, trying to get their attention. He says, "Whoso is simple, let him turn in hither. And as for him that wanteth understanding, she saith to him, stolen waters are sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant." A lot of times, people are tempted to do wrong simply for the excitement of doing wrong. And it doesn't just apply to the adultery that's described here, but different times we hear of people who get involved in stealing. There was a judge who was caught smuggling drugs, and he confessed, "I did it." He said, "I really didn't need the money, but it was exciting, seeing if I could get away with it." And a lot of times, people are enticed simply for the excitement of being involved in something that they know they shouldn't. They might do it on a dare. It says in verse 18, "But he knoweth not that the dead are there, and that her guests are in the depths of hell." Again, getting back to the consequences of the actions of being involved with the immoral woman. Well, that brings us to a close of chapters 1 through 9. Beginning Wednesday night, Matt is going to cover wisdom and righteousness. And we'll be looking, at least for the next few lessons, on more topical type studies.